My name is Karen Blomquist, and I've previously introduced myself to at other sessions as being the Director of Studies for the Commission for Church and Society of the ELCA. And so three of the sessions that I've been leading this week are dealing with sexual ethics and some reflections that have some relationship to, although not necessarily that directly, to some of the work I'm involved in as the staff director for the ELCA study on sexuality, which will hopefully be out sometime this fall. And after that, deliberation and discussion and feedback on that from throughout the church, and then the drafting of a social statement on the basis of that feedback, et cetera, that we receive. So I do have a slip of paper here. If anyone here who's not signed this before would be interested in receiving a copy of the study, which will be about a 40 to 50 page study that we hope to have out by this fall, please sign and we'll see that you get a copy. The topic for tonight is compassion and order in sexual ethics. And I see this as a conversation where we can together talk about what I'm increasingly feeling is a kind of necessary tension or balance or dialectic, if you want to use a fancier word, between compassion or what we might call a loving, tender, fulfilling relationship between two people on the one hand, and a kind of need for order, structure, limitations, boundaries on the other. And in order to get into that a little bit, I want to first of all just say some general things about how I think we need to approach the topic of sexual ethics. First of all, I think it's increasingly clear that sexuality needs to be affirmed as God's good gift, as God's good gift in all of its diversity, and therefore something that is to be celebrated and to be respected and to be lived out. But at the same time, we're also aware that in addition to being able to be celebrating that good gift, we also live as St. Paul and others put it, in the old order of sin, or in other words, where the gift is continually being distorted or compromised or violated. Certainly, we could probably all think of lots of ways in which that happens. And I'm not now thinking of what have been the traditional ways when we think of, well, somehow sin and sexuality are intertwined. But I'm thinking of some of the contemporary ways in which that occurs. For example, when sexuality is treated too lightly or too superficially. I think this happens particularly in terms of the commodification of sexuality, as we see it in advertising and, you know, all the ways in which sexuality and sexual innuendos are a part of, you know, the advertising world and getting us to buy what we're supposed to want to buy. And also certainly the various ways in which sexuality gets demeaned and exploited through certain forms of pornography, for example. But I think there's also a sense in which sexuality is treated too superficially or too narrowly, perhaps, when we think of sexuality as something that is only limited to genital sexual activity, so that among other things, the assumption therefore immediately is made that those who are not in a quote sexual relationship are somehow asexual or are not sexual beings. I think there's also certainly the real danger in our day that too much gets made out of sexuality in our society, so that sexual gratification, for example, becomes the goal or purpose of life. We become almost obsessed with sexuality, and therefore, or with sex, and therefore sex, in a sense, becomes our God. Certainly there's been an increasing awareness that we need to find a lot of ways to affirm ourselves as sexual beings. And I think that really is a central theological point if we take seriously what it means to respect and celebrate God's gift of our sexuality. It seems as though that needs to be linked with the need to affirm who we are as sexual beings. Instead of that, I think a lot of what has happened, and various people who've done work in Christian sexual ethics, I'm thinking of people like James Nelson, have in recent years done a lot of emphasizing of how perhaps one of the chief sins is that of alienation from our bodies, being out of touch with who we are as sexual beings. Not too long ago, I heard someone who works with sex offenders maintain that those who he works with, who have been charged with some kind of sexual offense, most typically are people who are very out of touch with their bodies, for whom sexuality was, you know, very much a taboo subject as they were growing up, and the kind of touch, the kind of familiarity with one's body and with oneself as a sexual being is what they were very much closed off from. And so it isn't that sex offenders are people who are just, you know, have all of this sex stuff that they're dealing with, but it's more often than not having grown up with sexuality and sex being just very, very taboo, and one's body being, you know, feeling very alienated from one's body. I think another part of the current scene that in many ways has kind of thrown a curveball into what I think have been some of the developments around sexuality in the last 20, 30 years, is the increasing awareness of the prevalence of sexual abuse in our society. And certainly there are, you know, lots of statistics that point to the number of cases or the percentage or the rate of sexual abuse. For example, 2/5 of adult women in the U.S. have experienced a completed or attempted sexual assault. 1 in 7 women who have ever been married have been raped by a husband or by an ex-husband. 2/5 of adult women have experienced sexual harassment. And a number of other statistics like that, including, at least within the church, and within other helping professions, the estimate that is often used today, that 1 out of 10 counselors, clergy, doctors, or lawyers have, in one way or another, sexually exploited their clients. So the whole epidemic of sexual violence, as we've become aware of it, especially since the 80s. Has come along the stream. I would say in the 60s, one could talk about a lot of the sexual revolution kinds of dynamics that were going on at that point, and a lot of challenging of some of the taboos and some of the limits, and rethinking, now what does it really mean to talk about having a life-fulfilling, life-enhancing, meaningful sexual relationship with another person, and then all of a sudden when we begin to realize that the need for boundaries is still very much, you know, a very important kind of thing. And I think coming to that realization, especially with, you know, as we affirm ourselves as sexual beings and become more comfortable with that, we also realize that we live in diverse communities that are also likely to be sexual. In other words, where there are likely to be sexual feelings and sexual attractions that are present, and therefore a real need to find some ways to respect those dynamics and to set some boundaries, some discipline, and discipline in that context. context becoming perhaps a retrievable word, especially for those of us who might have gone through eras where we said, oh, you know, all these boundaries and disciplines may not be that helpful. Now all of a sudden we're kind of doing a rebound and saying, hey, there is some real need for setting some limits, for talking about what are appropriate standards, what are unwelcome gestures. I'm thinking now particularly in the area of sexual harassment. And I think at times some of that has often become almost crazy. It's like we go bouncing from one extreme to the other. A few months ago, I remember being at a task force meeting with one of the bishops of the ELCA from Minnesota, and as we passed the peace, and he said, gee, it was sure great to pass the peace again. He says, I'm having to tell pastors of my synod that they can't do that anymore because of the very restrictive Minnesota law that could lead to some charges of sexual abuse if there is what is interpreted as inappropriate touch. So, you know, I think that it's been a very kind of bouncing back and forth kind of time over the last 20, 30 years of being able to open up some things and to say, okay, now let's begin to talk about the quality of relationships rather than only being focused on the structure or the boundaries or the is it in or outside of marriage, those kinds of concerns. And now all of a sudden we're realizing, hey, there's perhaps some important things to do with those boundaries that we can't just throw out and say, well, anything goes. I think also there's more and more of an awareness that boundaries are important because they serve a kind of protecting function that is important, protecting us from harm, from hurt, and also that they serve to structure our relationships or structure our structures and commitments and boundaries, also can enable the depth of our sexuality to flourish. And so that there really can be a sharing of vulnerability and a safe place and the expectation and the knowledge that, hey, that other person is going to be there for me. I can open myself up, I can be as vulnerable as possible, but knowing that, hey, there's a commitment there that is not going to let me down. And I think all of those dynamics are an important kind of thing to be aware of. The difficulty, of course, when we try to relate a lot of this kind of contemporary situation of the need to talk about quality of relationships on the one hand, and compassion is one way we might talk about the quality. And alongside that, the dialectical tension with order is the fact that in the biblical material, most of the focus is on order. And there's not an awful lot of really helpful material, at least not in an explicitly sexual sense, to help us flesh out, talk about what the quality of that relationship is likely to be or should be. I think the two exceptions, one would be a very passing reference in Genesis where it does say Jacob loved, I guess it's Rachel, Jacob loved Rachel, but most of the other relationships that one finds described in the narratives of the Bible, which quite frankly I think we need to give a lot more attention to when we look at sexual ethics. Usually we, you know, gravitate to the laws or, you know, Leviticus, but they're the kind of surprise and the kind of delight and the kind of strange turns of events in some of those narratives as one finds them in Genesis or elsewhere. It has a kind of, you know, kind of messiness of life where one can say, oh, you know, this is what God's people were doing, you know, you know, doing all the, you know, training one wife and doing this, and, you know, gee, you know, that makes some of our sexual practices today look rather mild in comparison. But that very quick, that passing verse in Genesis, and then, of course, Song of Songs, which those of you who have been around for a while, we used some portion of that for Vespers about a week and a half ago. And if you haven't read Song of Songs, I really encourage you to do so. You know, it doesn't get read much in our churches because there's a kind of utter delight in erotic pleasure that's conveyed there that makes some of the most steamy novels pale in comparison. And I think it's a very interesting view of what that kind of erotic yearning for one another, how it is poetically depicted there. Because if one reads the text, one discovers, well, they're doing it kind of undercover. In other words, this probably wasn't what we would think of as a, quote, married, you know, safe married relationship. There's an incredible mutuality between the man and the woman. I mean, she sings his praises as much as he does, and in as explicit a terminology as she does. It's probably an interracial couple. You know, they talk about, you know, one is very fair and the other is very dark. So there's a number of interesting features in that one piece of scripture where there is some focusing on the quality of relationship. Now, obviously, it's the, you know, kind of ecstatic falling in love. It's not necessarily the qualities that might sustain a relationship over the long haul, but nevertheless, I think it's an important, the fact that it is in scripture, I think itself says something rather powerful about, you know, a concern within the Hebrew tradition to say that, hey, sex is good, and it's not to be despised. So let me just share a couple of other things along this tension, and then I'm going to open this up and invite all of you into some conversation and to see what understandings, how you look at that matter of the tension between the quality of relationship and the need for some kind of structure, commitment, order to that relationship. I want to, in terms of this quality of relationship, just lay out a few things that might be jumping off points for talking about some characteristics of healthy sexual relationships. Healthy sexual relationships are safe spaces, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Violence, coercion, and threats are not acceptable. People are safe to talk about their real feelings, their real fears. They are able to share their imperfections and strengths with one another. People are able to disclose themselves and to take risks and to listen deeply to one another. Intimacy in these relationships is both emotional and physical. People are able to be vulnerable, to be received by the other, and to give to the other. Physical intimacy is deepened and sustained by personal sharing, and vice versa. The personal sharing deepens the physical intimacy. Touching and embracing are sometimes a matter of sexual delight, and at other times express closeness, protection, and acceptance. Trust and honesty must be created and nurtured. Trust can be broken or deepened. Learning effective but tactful ways of sharing information and feelings with the partner may be an essential step in moving from an unhealthy relationship toward a healthy relationship. Healthy relationships are respectful of both the body and the spirit of the other. Differences are accepted and respected. They are not threats. The integrity and well-being of the other and of the self are appreciated and cherished. The power in such relationships is not a controlling hierarchical power, but mutual power. With fairness, reciprocity, sharing in equal ways. Power is not based on a win versus lose paradigm. Partners do not seek to control each other, but to empower each other. Such relationships are always in a process of becoming through both brokenness and growth. We never, in a sense, arrive at the ideal healthy relationship. They are not static. A healthy relationship always involves work, repentance, renewal, movement, and change by the people engaged in it. There is freedom from unexamined sex role stereotypes. Individuals in the relationship are not boxed into received ideas about the proper roles and behavior of the partners in the relationship. They are free to reject qualities or activities that are, quote, supposed to be for their gender. Or they are free to affirm them if they in fact do fit. Self-acceptance. Healthy relationships are made possible by individuals who know and love themselves. The love of the cherished partner also makes possible a deepening self-acceptance. And finally, healthy sexual relationships involve joy, laughter, humor, playfulness. In other words, that essential dynamic that keeps us from taking ourselves too seriously. What I've just been sharing with you in the last few minutes is some rough drafting from the task force, and particularly arose out of a subgroup of the task force that included a wide variety of people, heterosexual and gay, married and not married, and a whole variety of people who spent some time saying, okay, now what really are some qualities of healthy sexual relationships? Then I want to share one other thing, and this is kind of some thinking in process that I've been doing recently. And it's to get at that whole dilemma of if we focus on what is important is the quality of the relationship. And of course, a lot of the media coverage of the Presbyterian report on sexuality, you know, really took off on that point, because, oh, they're talking all about the quality. Well, that must mean anything goes. And as I've been trying to say all along, I think we need to try to figure out how those two fit together so it doesn't just become a, well, anything goes. But I think there is that question of, does it become just a subjective kind of thing, you know, that somehow the two people say, well, you know, this is what seems to be right or feel right for the two of us. And it occurs, and immediately at that point is when people will say, well, aren't there some laws? Aren't there some givens? Aren't there, some standards that have to be there too? That standards that, in a sense, have some kind of objective status to them. So it's not just a subjective, you know, well, whatever works out between the two people. And what I've been thinking lately is that in loving another person, thinking now particularly in a sexual relationship, there's a sense in which, especially if it's not just the, you know, kind of the falling in love and the kind of, you know, the over the long haul, not just the kind of immediate erotic passion that one might feel for that person, but over the long run, hopefully there will also be the erotic passion over the long run, I'm not saying that should stop, but that the more one gets to know another person, one runs up against all kinds of factors about who that person is that in a sense become givens about who that person is. So we might say, oh, well, you know, I was really attracted to this person because of such and such and such and such. And then all of a sudden, after 3 years or 7 years or 13 years, it's like, oh, yeah, there's all these other factors that I, you know, hadn't quite bargained for when I, quote, fell in love. And some of that might be in terms of the, you know, the family upbringing of that person and their, the way in which they see themselves as male or female. Some of it may relate to how comfortable they feel in terms of their own sexual orientation. A number of them may be, you know, social, familial factors, you know, what the sexual mores were, what, you know, what went on in the community that they grew up, some of the, you know, dysfunctional family dynamics and how that has played into the givenness of who someone is. And in using givenness, I'm not saying this is all unchangeable, but I'm trying to say, you know, there's a whole array of factors that I confront in confronting the otherness of the person with whom I am in that ongoing sexual relationship. And so there's a sense in which that multifaceted givenness of all the factors that go into who that person is, I think provides itself a kind of law or order to our love. In other words, we can't just operate with our subjective feelings, or certainly not just what we would want that person to become. The other person always ends up being so different from me, no matter how much we might seem to be alike on the surface, and therefore that tends to confound all of our tendencies to define or to control the relationship on our terms. And the overall reality of who that other person is, in its own way, gives some form and substance to that place where we have made a commitment and where we live out our vocation as sexual beings in relationship to one another. Now, I'm not by that suggesting that there isn't still this need for these other objective factors and boundaries, etc. Because certainly it's more than just, you know, the two of us. There's all the factors and all the communities we live in, and with all of the kinds of practices of infidelity and all the other things. Those are, you know, thinking through the importance of those boundaries is not an insignificant kind of matter. But I think it would be interesting, and I'm going to stop now and hear some of your ideas or reflections in relationship to what I've been saying. How you see that relationship between compassion and order, recognizing that sexuality has that kind of unleashed power, and that's what we delight in, that's what we celebrate, and I think that's what, after many hundreds of years of really the church having been so negative about sexuality, that we need to retrieve and celebrate. But I think, quite frankly, a lot of the nervousness in the church and in society these days, a nervousness that, for example, manifests itself, especially when the issue of homosexuality comes up, because it's like, oh, well, we let, you know, there were all these things that took place in the 60s, you know, of greater sexual freedom, et cetera, and now this is a place where we're going to draw the line. And so my own feeling is that to talk about these issues in the church and, you know, wherever we are, we need to honor what I think are some important emphasis from both of those directions, and to say, okay, we need both of those. Now, is it possible then to have a common conversation that says, hey, the rules, the order, the commitments, that's a very crucial part of how this gift that we want to celebrate can flourish. But how do we go about doing that and having those conversations? So I'll stop and hear your comments or suggestions or challenges to what I've been saying. Scott?
It occurs to me as I listen to your talk, I hadn't thought of this before. This is a new thought right on the spot here. And that is the relationship between order and abuse. Is our need for order now come from our, we don't know what abuse is.
Hmm.
Abuse gets defined as, I suppose the courts are defining abuse. If one person says, I've been abused, does that make them abused? We're afraid to hug each other for fear that somebody might say, you're abusing me. And so we're kind of letting our society somehow decline. I don't know. I mean, we're kind of, is it because, where is this, you know, right, the 60s and the 70s were, you know, kind of, the door was thrown up and all kinds of experimentation went on, and we found out that all kinds of behavior, we learned through experience about what, to a certain extent, perhaps what behavior is destructive and what behavior isn't. And now we're going the other direction. People are kind of shutting down.
Yeah, I think there's a real danger of you know, the pendulum swinging way the other way. The other thing, though, about the, you know, the whole epidemic of sexual abuse, the need for the boundaries, but also a need to recognize that some of the, quote, officially committed relationships, in other words, within marriage itself, can be a very unhelpful boundary, namely as a kind of cover or a sanction for abuse. So, well, you know, the man says, if this is my wife, I'll do whatever I damn well please with her. So, you know, that can play itself both ways in terms of how abuse relates to the issue of order and, you know,
I mean,
it can provide a cover for it within marriage, but certainly then it creates the difficulty of, you know, how do we develop common expectations? And I think you're right. You know, the fact that the expectations are so diverse out there, it's like now, well, okay, then we've got to go through the legal system and come up with some standards of what is or is not, and it's a.
I mean, the way dysfunction is being defined, there ain't nobody that ain't dysfunctional. Or hasn't experienced that in some way, or isn't a part of a relationship that's somehow dysfunctional. I mean, you could hold a convention for people who are not dysfunctional on telephone. But, and or being defined as such. Well, I don't know, I just think it's an interesting dilemma. Really complex to me. I certainly haven't sorted it out.
In the back, Carol.
Yeah. Hasn't there been something written recently about the relationship of abuse? There's something to do with the relationship of being in an abusive situation when you're a child and to people who don't know boundaries. I'm not quite sure.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Scott, maybe you, Karen, could say something about that. But I guess I feel like I've run into that a couple of times now, and I'd like to read something about that. But is there some connection there that somebody could speak to? And is it always the same? If you've been abused sexually, then you don't know boundaries about sexual abuse or sexual boundaries? Or is it sort of a jump? Like you might have been abused emotionally, but you end up being a person that doesn't know boundaries, say, in some other category. That fascinates me.
I've heard that referred to. I mean, I do not consider myself an expert in that topic of sexual abuse or its treatment, etc. So I rely on others at that point. I don't know if there are others who... Certainly there is the phenomena of those who are abusive as adults. A very high percentage of them were victims of sexual abuse as children.
Yeah, I know. The idea of boundaries and order struck me, and
mm-hmm.
I was just trying to think through that together.
Mm-hmm.
I also have In my ministry, I've not yet married anyone who has not been living together before they were married, except a couple that were in their 60s. And then they're the only ones that could afford that risk. And they didn't take it. So, but it seems to me that one of the things I see happening in that whole area is it would be nice to be able to have the church have another look at what betrothal is. And I think that the Catholic Church now has moved into a period of time where you have to be committed to a marriage 6 months beforehand. You have to go through 6 months worth of premarital counseling. But it seems to me it would be helpful if we, since we are marrying later, it would be nice if we had a betrothal period again, not like the Middle Ages where the idea was to find out if the person was could produce heirs for this marriage, but instead worked on relationships and particularly said, no, we won't have children in this period. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
It's been very interesting because on Tuesday I was talking about Countryman's book, Dirt, Greed, and Sex, which is New Testament ethics, even though the title might sound a little more risque than that. And one of the proposals he makes at the end of it is the kind of thing you're talking about. I mean, his proposal is that years into the relationship, that's when the church should step in and bless it, because it's at that point that one could say, hey, what in fact are we blessing? You know, what is the quality of this relationship? You know, one can, I've certainly married people who, you know, you kind of repeat all those nice flowery stuff when you as the clergy person are marrying them, and it's like, you know, well, it's certainly not sinking in the excitement of the wedding, etc. Yeah, I think the whole phenomena of couples wanting to reaffirm their marriage vows is reflecting that, hey, you know, we didn't know all that we were getting into, perhaps, and we didn't know the richness of what that relationship could be at that point. So he's making that proposal, saying dirt, greed, and sex. I mean, it's not, he doesn't spend a lot of time talking about it, but it is because of the need to talk about much more about the quality of relationships and, you know, and recognizing that, you know, our practices of blessing marriages is, you know, not necessarily that biblical. So.
Yeah, I had a question as far as how the children fit into the boundary discussion in the task force. You know, there are lots of controversial aspects to that, but I just need a general form.
Well, one of the things I didn't say when I was going through some of the aspects of why law, you know, why commitment, order, boundary is important is obviously that need to provide that kind of stable, enduring environment within which children can be raised. I suppose the reason I didn't talk about it that much is I think it is dramatic how different our era is from almost any recorded era in terms of not thinking of sexuality as, you know, sexuality equals procreation. So you're right, I didn't address myself to that, but I think a part of why commitment and fidelity is important is because of the need to talk about not just what is life-enhancing for the two people, but what is life-giving, including bringing new children into the world, or other ways in which that relationship might be life-giving. So I think, if anything, this broader, you know, these beginning fragments of what could be a broader perspective is intended to give far more solidity to that kind of environment and that kind of context within which children could be raised. You know, unlike what is, you know, a very prevalent situation in our day where, you know, many children are growing up in situations of what some have called serial monogamy, you know, and have, you know, all various kinds of blended families in our day. So I didn't neglect that because that's not important, but I think, you know, it's so difficult for us to have that long-term, I'm not dealing now exactly with the question you raised, but, you know, the whole notion of the romantic reasons for getting married is so recent in history, you know, 19th century or one of those different strands one can look at, and even in the 19th and through much of the 20th century, we're talking about what is primarily a white middle class reason for getting married. And therefore, you know, in terms of communities of color and poor and working class kinds of communities, in many of those communities, the centrality of procreation as the reason for getting married, was the case, and it continues to be the case, in a way that isn't necessarily true for a lot of white working class or white middle class folks, and you know the whole forgot what is the successor group to the yuppies, the dinks, yeah, the double income, no kids kind of phenomenon.
One of the things that, and I don't know, I came in late, so I don't know what you said before I got here, but one of the things that seems to be kind of not stated so far, and I know that there's a lot of pages you didn't mention, so, is the sense that, you know, you talked a lot about how these couples view each other and what kind of characteristics they see in a healthy healthy relationship between. In what sense does this report talk about how God enters this relationship and makes it somehow different, stand apart from the rest of culture? And then I guess kind of thinking about it, how is this report standing over and against what the rest of culture says? Because most of what I heard, I can read a lot of books about sexuality that have nothing to do with God. Mm-hmm. And God's kind of infusing in this relationship. I want to have something to say too about the marriage itself, the vows, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and what God does.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me just say that even though I didn't flesh all that out, and you're right, I didn't get into that in this particular session. Some of the members of our task force have really been reflecting on how the compassion and holiness dynamic, which is a little bit different than what I said, but holiness was to impose order, is a central dynamic and a central tension undergirding Scripture in both Old Testament and New Testament. A couple of days ago, I was pointing to, you know, the way in which Jesus deals with some of that holiness tradition, not just throwing it all out, but increasingly compassion becomes a higher priority than for example, clinging to the purity rules that were a part of Hebrew culture. So I would say, you know, the kind of thing I was talking about, I think one can talk about that in terms of, you know, compassion is a very biblical word as to how the Hebrew people and how Christians too understand God's activity. And one could talk about this in a kind of law and gospel kind of dialectic too. But I think one of the main reasons that we could talk about, and that actually in some other stuff we are doing some drafting that begins to move in that direction, one of the reasons that the most careful stewardship of our sexuality is needed, and I think careful stewardship is one good biblical way to talk about that, is because that intimate relationship does mirror or reflect the close relationship between God and God's people. And a lot of, you know, the understandings of commitment have some relationship to understandings of God's faithfulness and God's loyalty, and you know, unfortunately, some of the metaphors and imagery that it's used to talk about that, it's God going after the whoring wife, and you know, I'm thinking that in some of the prophets, you know, some of the imagery is problematic as to how that was used, you know, within a very patriarchal women as property kind of worldview. But I think certainly that understanding of commitment and loyalty, and the importance of law, of there being some standards, not just anything goes, even though, as I was saying a couple nights ago, I think there is the ongoing need to test how that law does apply in a given situation. In other words, the moral mandates, we need to continually say now, what context were they functioning in, and is the context really the same here? And that, you know, that's a difficult kind of task, because certainly we can all deceive ourselves and say, oh, well, I don't really want that law. I don't want to have to worry about that law dealing with adultery or this or that. But to try to say now, what purpose was that serving? I think even Jesus' very restrictive word, or his what to many of us today might look as really harsh words on the topic of divorce, were intended really to restore some order so that the woman, in fact, had some rights, and so that the man couldn't just arbitrarily dismiss her for anything under the sun. So I think there's, you know, a number of things operating there, but I also feel that it's very difficult for us to try to just directly appropriate a lot of the biblical material and assume it applies in the same way in our own day. Certainly there are some things that are, you know, that are key in that, but I think we need to look at how directly, you know, look carefully at how directly we can just appropriate some of that material. One of the things that the task force is wanting to do, and we do have a piece that's in the process, is a rather lengthy treatment of how sexuality was viewed in Scripture in a historical context, and to try to understand some of those dynamics so that it's not just a matter of getting beyond what can be a very unhelpful kind of proof texting when the topic of sexuality comes up. Up there.
Don't you think that a lot of the reason for all the order in the Old Testament and even the New Testament, though, was the view that women were essentially property, and they had rules and regulations for all the other property, and they had it for the sex, and it was a drive that was very strong, and so it had to actually have more rules than others, and the abuse was not really viewed as abuse any more than if somebody were to go out and abuse their horse or their oxen, because you were dealing with property. And until we got to the point where women were not seen as property, before you could actually get away from the rules. And so we went, you know, way this direction, and then found out that you still have to have rules when you're dealing with two people.
No, I think that's very well put, because that was certainly what was operating. I mean, even in Luther's, in the Ten Commandments, and Luther's explanation of the Ten Commandments, when you get to 9 and 10, what's wrong with coveting the other man's wife is the same thing that's wrong with coveting his cattle or his this or that or whatever. And so it's that property ethic is very much there. That's why, you know, I think we do have to really stretch things to say, oh, well, the Bible's really concerned about a sexual ethic based on love and justice. I think love and justice needs to become the central focus of an ethic dealing with sexuality today. But again, that in part is related to our expanded understanding of sexuality being related to the whole of who we are, and it having to do with holistic relationships, not just with genital sexual activity. And I think that broadened understanding of sexuality, which I think is itself biblical, causes us to look in different places for what can be the most helpful biblical material to inform the development of a sexual ethic today. Now that is not likely to be satisfying to many in our churches who still feel, well, this is what it says about sex, and therefore that's all you need to look for. Why talk about Jesus saying, love one another as you love yourself? You know, which I think needs to be at the core of a sexual ethic, but except even in that, certainly in that era, you know, the kind of feeling free to fall in love with and marry whoever. I mean, you know, arranged marriages, I think, have been certainly the predominant pattern through, you know, most of recorded history. And in many countries still today. So I think there are some threads, there are some things we can retrieve from back there. But you know, there's all of the kinds of stuff that happened, for example, in the early centuries of the church, with sex being seen as sin, and just some incredible developments there. So that based on a kind of body-spirit dualism, and women associated with the body, and therefore to be holy, to be spiritual, is to be somehow avoid all of that. And, you know, Augustine being one of the probably worst cases, but there's a bunch of others too. And I think some aspects of that, you know, really continue to be with us, even though in the Victorian era in this country and in Europe in the late 19th century, in some ways it was a reverse, because then it was, well, women are asexual, and you know, women needing to tame these lusty men who, whereas before it was, women are the temptress, Tertullian, women are the devil's gateway, and all that sort of thing. It was in the Victorian era, it was almost a reverse of that, even though it still led to the same, a similar kind of suspicion about sexuality as being.
I deal more with teenagers. It seems like something that sort of is lacking with teenagers is any kind of sense of boundaries, except maybe that the fear of sexual diseases have heightened the need for some kind of boundaries. Will this report have anything to say about teenage sex and teenage sexuality?
Yeah, at this point, I'm not sure how much or what the task force is going to end up saying on that. That's a very real concern, though. I would say three of the main areas of concern are, okay, where do we draw the lines? And certainly, whether one's talking on the younger end of the spectrum in terms of teenagers, or the older end of the spectrum too. We didn't get into this, but certainly there are a number of older couples who are saying, well, you know, we're not sure we want to legally get married, especially if it means both of us, or one or the other of us, losing our Social Security. And we've gotten letters saying, hey, you know, why doesn't the church bless the union of these two people? They may not want to legally get married, but there is a kind of real commitment to one another, and economically, they're not going to make it if she, for example, has to give up her Social Security by legally getting married. That's getting off the subject, but when I think of one end of the spectrum, I think of the other. So that whole thing of where do we draw the lines, and saying, yeah, boundaries are important. I don't know how we're going to deal with the fact that the kind of, well, just say no kind of thing is probably not getting through to that many teenagers. But I think it is a matter of saying, okay, why are the boundaries important? And I would appreciate some advice, some help from those of you who work with teenagers about how that could be more effectively communicated. And I think, in all of this, it's a matter of how do we help people understand why that's necessary, not just because mom or dad says so or because the Bible says so, but because, hey, you know, it makes some sense because of this relationship that I'd really like to flourish, and you know, what is it that can help make that flourish? So I don't know how that, I would really appreciate some help as to how that can be communicated in some effective ways to teenagers that makes sense, and it isn't just saying, oh, well, here goes the church saying don't have any sex outside of marriage. How can we communicate why those boundaries, et cetera, are important? The other two areas that you can probably guess what they are, one is abuse of power in sexuality. In fact, compared to what the church statements in the Lutheran churches have said before, we early on identified that the importance of looking at power is a crucial ethical issue. And there are many on our task force that would say abusive use of power is perhaps the, you know, if we have to talk about sexual sin, is perhaps the sexual sin and the issue that we need to look at in all of its various manifestations, the non-consensual sexual activity. And then thirdly, obviously, is same-sex relationships. You know, and of course there we're dealing with an even different situation of the order. If we're consistent in this and saying that the quality is important, and for the quality, that commitment, that order is necessary, then, you know, I think it raises some real questions of, you know, well, do we or do we not provide any support so that there might be a flourishing of quality relationships?
You think you can write this without alienating at least a third of the church?
No.
on one side or the other?
No, it's...
It seemed to me you gave it your best shot in the abortion state. Do you see a path?
Well, part of what I'm dealing with now, and I'm not sure how this is going to be incorporated in it, but is to struggle to say, is there a way of framing the debate here where we acknowledge some of the values on both or many sides? You know, in other words, get beyond just the kind of reaction of, oh, well, if you talk about quality of relationship, then you're just clearly following the same road to hell that those who advocated all of the sexual liberation in the 60s, you know, that it's all seen as one fabric, or the other side of people saying, oh, well, don't give us all these laws and these rules because, you know, that's all the repression, etc. And I don't know, I would like to be hopeful in a number of ways, but especially hopeful to say that maybe in the 90s we can look up at the need for both, you know, the both and to try to hear what are the important values coming from what we could call a more conserving voice and a more liberating voice. But, you know, that there's very different experiences that people have and that caused them to feel so strongly about one pole or the other. I don't know if I want to even call them one pole, because it's a matter of saying, hey, somehow that all needs to be a part of the same whole. I think because of the nature of the topic and, in a sense, our continuing obsession as a society with sexuality to try to come out with some way of dealing with this that isn't going to alienate a big segment is very difficult to think about.
Did you read the report that the Presbyterians prepared and it was rejected apparently by their church?
Yes, uh-huh. In fact, I have it with me.
I can't remember the term that was linked with that. Justice? Sex?
Just love.
Justice love.
Yeah, justice love.
And apparently that was rejected by the National Church, or the body.
Yeah, I don't, because I came to the village just as the news articles were coming out of that, I really haven't seen a full report of what really was being rejected. You're right, the news media said they rejected that report. But I cannot quite believe that the whole of what was being said in there was just being rejected out of hand. I think it may not have been expressed as carefully as it might have.
Yeah, just from the bits.
And I think the order and the, you know, do we take that biblical stuff seriously? I would say there probably wasn't as much attention given to that as would need to be in order to reassure some people that, hey, you know, when you focus on quality of relationships, right, which in part is what I'm saying here too, that doesn't mean that anything goes. There's got to be some, it's got to be a both and kind of thing.